Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Pride. We speak to the bakers who created a custom wedding cake for Charlie Craig and David Mullins, the couple behind the Masterpiece Cake Shop Supreme Court case.
We felt that what happened to Charlie and David was an absolute injustice.
Kat Johnson addresses the controversy surrounding Anthony Porosky, Queer Eye's food and wine expert.
Many viewers thought these recipes were unsophisticated.
And finally, Hannah Forden speaks with nutrition educator Leah Kurtz about the relationship between veganism and queer identity.
It's an interesting way in which food can challenge invisible value systems even greater than sexuality does.
Listen to Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, this week, and celebrate Pride with HRN. Available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening apps.
Welcome to The Line here on Heritage Radio. Before we get into the show, a quick note on our summer fun drive. It's going on right now, and it's our goal to raise $25,000. So why would you join Heritage Radio Network? By becoming a member. So what is Heritage Radio Network really worth to you? If you tune in once a week or every day, we'd love to have you help us continue to bring you the most entertaining and thought-provoking stories from the world of food and beverage. So you could set up a monthly recurring donation for just $5 a month, you can get an individual membership, or for $10 a month, you can get a household membership. Please help us make Heritage Radio Network here to stay and here for a very long time. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate. And now let's get into the program. Each episode on The Line, I sit down with a chef or restaurateur to track the line of their career development, from first jobs in food to culinary school or not, to discussing their current position. Today, my guest is Emma Benson. She is the executive chef of Aquavit. She moved to New York in 2010 to work at Aquavit in the pastry department, and then was quickly promoted, taking over the entire restaurant as executive chef in 2014. Since then, she has been named a top chef in New York City by multiple publications, including New York Magazine. She was nominated for a 2017 James Beard Award, and the restaurant currently holds 2 Michelin stars. Chef, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You grew up in the town of Falkenberg in Sweden's west coast. It's north of Copenhagen by a couple hours.
Give or take 5-6 hours, maybe.
Okay, so it's not a huge town. It's somewhat of a tourist destination a little bit. I'm curious, what is it like growing up in a small coastal town in Sweden? What was your childhood like there?
Wow, it was amazing. I was one of those kids who could never sit still, so I had projects going all the time, everything from gymnastic to horses to fishing to everything I could imagine getting my hands on. And I think being able to grow up that close to the water also developed my my taste for seafood and real good seafood from clean water. So for me, that's been a blessing to be able to have that already as a kid.
What are some of the traditionally eaten fish in your village or in all of Sweden that come close by or directly out of the waters there?
So Falkenberg is it's very famous for its salmon. And I remember growing up that salmon was it was a luxury. It was something that I loved to eat, and I could only get it on maybe Saturdays or if it was a party or anything like that. And you can see how much the seafood have changed in that not many years from now, where salmon is not considered to be a very sought-out fish. And I think having the value that appreciate the seafood and the quality have really changed the way I see.
When you talk about salmon, we're talking about gravlax, like a a curing preparation? Are we talking about a salmon fillet that is seared or roasted in the oven? Like, what's a what are the ways that you grew up eating it?
I think one my favorite thing was always gravlax, and it's still one of my favorite preparations to eat salmon. But I can eat it in any forms, if it's poached or seared or.
Do you do a gravlax preparation at the restaurant right now?
Oh yes, is always. It,
and how, what is that traditionally served with? Like, what's the plate setup of a Swedish gravlax meal or plate setup?
So I'm always trying to have two versions of it. One more traditional, which is served with a kind of like a mustard and dill emulsion, and maybe just some lemon wedges. And then I try and do a version where it's a little bit more taking it into a new fun way of seeing it and using it. So I right now on the menu, it's served with watermelon, cucumber, and lovage. So you just to see a different way of how you can utilize the same product.
Is it traditionally eaten as a breakfast food, or is it any time of day that you eat it?
Any time of day. It doesn't matter. You can eat it whenever you want.
It's interesting because so I'm Jewish, and growing up, lox was special for my family as well. Sunday brunch, you had bagels and you had lox, but you didn't really ever eat it at another a different time. And not only was it would be weird to eat lox at dinner time, but also I always felt like mostly non-Jewish people or people who hadn't encountered a lot of Jewish people before, they were really surprised that you would eat something that has such an intense flavor. But a lot of the seafood in Sweden is cured and it has a lot of intense seafood fishiness to it, right? Like, that's a part of the cuisine, right?
Yeah, I mean, everything dates back to the days where refrigeration and things like that wasn't available. So a way to survive the winters and the long month where it was harder to get produce, we had to find a way of taking care of it and making it last. So that's where all the curing and brining and smoking and drying, all of those preparation is the base of the, I would say, all the Nordic cooking as of today. And that's something you'll see in every restaurant.
Going back to historical preparations and, you know, things being passed down from generation to generation, your grandmother played a large role in your life. And was she someone that you learned a lot of cooking technique from, life lessons? Like, what type of teacher and role did she play in your life?
I think the most important thing that I learned from her and that it's always stuck in my mind is that I saw the love for the cooking with her. She would be so satisfied spending days in the kitchen preparing something, and everything was always prepared from scratch. There were no shortcuts. There were no cans, nothing like that. Everything was always pure ingredients, not being overly complicated, just prepared with a lot of love and time. And I think that's one of the most important things when it comes to cooking. At least one of the things you need to learn first. And then you can go into all the fancy things afterwards if you feel like it. But
do you hold on to a lot of family recipes? Does anything still make it into your either personal cooking life or your professional cooking life?
There's definitely been recipes on the menu that's been based out of her recipes. They're everything from desserts to liver pâtés and things like that, where I get the inspiration from her and then tweak it a little bit and add things to it so I get a more of a modern feeling. But the base techniques are coming from her.
As someone who did pastry for a long time, is there anything from your childhood that you can remember sparking a serious interest? Is there a family cake or a traditional cake that you ate that you thought, I would love to know how to make this one day? Or was it kind of a gradual appreciation of pastry over time?
There was a couple of things, amongst other, a chocolate cake that my grandmother always used to make. And I very early on got the recipe for it, and we didn't live very close to each other. We were still 6 hours away, so I would get the recipes from her so I could actually make it at home for myself. And I think a lot of things like that was I found her doing it, and I liked it, and then I tried to do it myself.
You ended up going to culinary school, which you did at, by American standards, at a very young age. You started at age 15. You were in culinary school, right? Around then?
And yeah, almost 16, I think.
And that's really a time in someone's life when most people don't have anything figured out. You're still very young, maybe curious, maybe lazy, but that seems like a French style to me from afar. I think 15, 16 culinary school, that seems really intense. Was your culinary schooling very rigorous, or was it more like high school that had some cooking elements to it? What was that general experience like?
I think overall we're very blessed in many parts of Europe where you can actually, I wasn't very good at school, and I wasn't, I couldn't focus on the writing, and also coming up with a dyslexia and just having a really, really rough time with school, that we get to have the ability, if you wanted to go into a professional school as an option. You still get to do the basic things, but around 80% has to do with the profession you're choosing. And I remember that was the start of me actually doing well in school. I've been struggling my whole life, going through and feeling stupid and like an idiot, and then all of a sudden culinary school came along, and those classes actually helped me focus when I was in English or Swedish or math and things like that. So
it's something that I have actually encountered many times before, that lots of chefs have been dyslexic and they've felt alienated in early schooling and kind of isolated by that. Did you know that you were dyslexic? Was it called dyslexia, or were you kind of struggling with figuring out what was going on? And when you got to culinary school and you didn't necessarily need to be doing traditional learning, did it just kind of, was it the most freeing experience for you?
It was actually quite amazing to be able to be seen in another way. And back when I started school, dyslexia wasn't really anything that was on, was heard of. So you were just either a lazy student, or I had to go to speech therapy and learn things. So going into culinary school was a way where you could just learn in a different way. You learn with your hands, your eyes, and then if you didn't spell everything correctly or things like that, it didn't really matter, because it wasn't the point. But I feel like being able to do something like that and focus your energy on it, it helped my focus on the other things that I had to learn. And I actually went from a really bad student to actually doing really well in those classes as well, because it was more, I guess, accepted to be who you wanted to be.
When you started working at Zbaka Krug, was that an externship from culinary school, or had you graduated? It's a 2-Michelin-star restaurant, probably a very high-pressure work environment. You were quite young. What was that experience like? You didn't have a lot of kitchen experience at that point. So do you remember what your first days were like? Did they have you do some terrible tasks? Did they make you, you know, peel vegetables for for a week straight in the basement of the restaurant? Like, what was that first experience like?
I've done it, but I'm not at that restaurant. I was actually very, very lucky. I was terrified out of my bones the first day I walked in, and I remember I didn't really know what I was walking into and what a kitchen would be like, but come to think of it afterwards, I've been very blessed to have that as my first experience, because this was a restaurant where everyone treated everyone like family and everyone loved to be there. I know during the 5 years I've stayed there, I was one of the shortest employees in the kitchen. It wasn't, most people stay there 5-10 years, and that was only because the work environment in the kitchen was very professional and felt at home. So I've always carried that with me on when I'm searching for new places to start my work at, and that's also what is based in my kitchen today and how I run my kitchen today.
In your early life, what pushed you into your culinary pursuits? How open were your parents to you pursuing that path? In Sweden at that time, was it considered, was it an honorable profession? It sort of varies from country to country. Now it's, everyone says being a chef is wonderful. It's sort of reached a pinnacle of, it's kind of sexy now. So I think that people people, when they make that choice, there's not as much pushback. But I'm curious, when you decided to go to culinary school, what did your family think of it? And also, how did you decide that that might be the path for you at such a young age?
Being a chef was always on my agenda from very young age. It was, I think I had a short period of my time where I wanted to be a fire pilot, but that kind of died after after a little while when I realized how hard it was. But being or wanting to be a chef, my parents always supported me, and I remember the school I went to was in Stockholm, and obviously more circumstances than just me going to that school, but my whole family moved up that summer to live in Stockholm, part of me being able to be at that school at the time. So I've always felt 100% backed by them, and to be honest, I just think that they wanted us to do something that we would love to do than go into a profession when you're miserable your whole life. Maybe not everyone is that, but
I think that most people are, actually. Did you put anything ever on the menu at Edsbaka at Krug? Or I know you started working at the restaurant located in the Opera House. I'm curious if you can remember the first thing that you put on the menu, either pastry or not pastry. How did that feel to be working towards the goal of being in restaurants, and then, you know, putting something on the menu for the first time can feel really validating. It's terrifying and exciting, but do you remember what that dish may have been?
Oh, wow. No, not really. I do remember that I felt it was really cool at Edsbaka, where the head chefs would actually give us an idea of a dish, and then they would just say, figure it out. And that opened my mind that they would put enough trust in me to... sometimes it worked out, and sometimes it turned into a disaster. But there was this dish where they wanted to have this weird kind of horn-looking thing with vegetables coming out of it, and I just couldn't figure out how to create it. So I don't know how I came up with the idea, but I started rolling it around my fingers, kind of claw, bending them and rolling this straight out of oven honey twill around my fingers, burning really hot, but it worked. And then I think, God, it was on the menu for 3 months.
And you had to do it every single day.
I had to do it every single day. And I was the only one who did it. And I think I lost all the feelings I had in my fingers during that time. But I remember it being worth it, because the end product was something that they really liked. And that was one of those moments where you're okay, a little pain is fine. I can deal with it.
innovation through self-inflicted pain. Sounds like a microcosm of the kitchen. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to start talking about your move to New York and working at Aquavit. Stick with us here on The Line.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
Welcome back to The Line here on Heritage Radio. My guest today is Chef Emma Benson. She is the chef of Aquavit, a 2 Michelin star restaurant in New York City. I want to know about when you came to New York to take the job. You had barely been to New York before, right? You had been one time for a very short period of time and you took the job. Was it a leap of faith, or did you just feel confident that it was going to be the right fit for you?
I traveled by New York, I think 2 years earlier, 3 years earlier from a trip back from Mexico, and it was just a 2-day layover. And I just remember walking. All I did was walk for like 2 days and just experience the pulse and the energy and the flow of the city. And then going home after that, I was... For 2 years, all I wanted to do was go back to New York, and it's not easy. You have to have and get a way in to be able to move here. So when that phone call or that opportunity finally came, it wasn't even a question if I should do it or not. It was more of how I should do it and when I could go. So it's... It's a city that you can't really forget. Once you fall in love with it, it's over.
So you get off the plane. Where do you move to in New York City? And for those that don't know, where's Aquavit? So you're in the sort of skyscraper central of New York City, probably a very, very intense differential from where you were coming from.
Yeah, so we're on 55th between Madison and Park, which is smack in the middle, and coming here I knew that this was going to take a lot of work from me, so I didn't want to be too far away. I would want to be able to walk to work, and to make that happen I found 2 fellow Swedes and we rented this tiny little 2-bedroom apartment on 66 and First, I think. And it's so strange because I've been living on my own or like living outside when not having like anyone to share the rooms with or like the apartments with. So all of a sudden 3 girls in this tiny little apartment was very strange to me, but it didn't really matter because all I was focusing on was always the work. And But I think now I moved away a year later and I tried a couple of different things, and now I found my spot up in Harlem, where I really love being able to get that calmness and the neighborhood feeling out of it, and then actually travel to work. So
Do you ever swing by fellow Aquavit alum? His restaurant is in Harlem, right? Isn't Marcus have a couple restaurants up there?
Oh, yeah, he does. I just moved again, but we used to be neighbors for many years.
Very nice. I want to talk about Aquavit and the type of cuisine that it cooks. So Aquavit has been open for a very long time, since 1987. And is it fair to say that it serves Nordic cuisine? Is that how it is, how it can be described?
Yes.
you seem unhappy with that. If there's a better way, please correct me. But this style, this categorization has recently sort of exploded into the cooking vernacular. Everyone seems to be aware of Nordic cuisine now. One of the people, if not the person who has been responsible for it from like a media perspective, is Rene Redzepi in Copenhagen, Magnus Nielsen as well. And you have obviously been recognized, and so has Aquavit, but is there any part of you that feels that Aquavit hasn't necessarily been given some of the credit it deserves, since it's been around for such a long time? Like, it's been at the forefront of this type of cuisine. Do you feel like some of Aquavit has been lost in that discussion?
I'm not sure if I think lost is the right thing to say. I mean, when it comes to Swedish and Nordic food, it's been around for a very, very long time. And obviously we're all very happy and grateful for Noma to put it out on the map. It's been a way for the rest of the world to open up their eyes and see what's going on and actually start focusing on the Nordic countries. And it's just a way of saying that Aquavit has been in New York for 30 years and people here knows about it. And I'm thankful that everything that Rene has done, because it makes more people find us and know that we're actually there. And it's a little bit of a different cuisine as well when you're talking about what he's doing towards what we're doing. It's always different as soon as you go out of your countries and you start cooking your food in another country. It's not really the same. You can try as much as possible to do it, but then it's still, there's a little bit of a difference to it.
In terms of Aquavit's price point, it's obviously, it's a 2-Michelin-star restaurant. It's quite expensive. By New York, it's actually kind of middle of the road or even less expensive than a lot of Michelin-starred restaurants. But just as a chef and being the leader in the kitchen, from a food cost perspective in a fine dining restaurant, this is something that always I find really fascinating. Can we talk about the bottom line, and does it really play a role in your sort of creative conceptualization, or does it not for some reason that you can explain?
I definitely think that food cost plays a big part of running your restaurant. Everyone knows that if you start ignoring it, eventually it will turn into you closing the restaurant. But I think there's different ways to go around it. And I've always believed more about the food waste than actually the food cost. I've always been very concerned that we shouldn't throw away food. We should look to all the resources we have and be responsible with it. The last thing I've ever want to do is throw something away because it doesn't have the perfect shape. That doesn't mean it can't taste amazing. So I think more and more you will see over the course of the years, you'll see more and more fine dining restaurants actually starting to utilize big all the produce that you have. And that's where different cuts coming in as well. If you know how to cook certain things, you don't have to use the filet mignon or the foie gras or things like that. That's in a part of me thinking that's a very easy cooking. be utilizing products or cuts from meats and animals that no one else is using, it's a way of using whole products, and that will also affect your food costs in a better way.
That's definitely a turn from maybe 10, 15 years ago, when really obtaining that perfect slice, the perfect shape, the square, whatever it might be, the perfect piece of herb was the end goal. And high-end restaurants could have probably been guilty of creating maybe the most food waste. Mm-hmm. And really, like a mom and pop joint where they were doing everything to not waste any little bit was actually approaching things with the method that you've just talked about. So as you continue to use everything and try to get your food waste to zero, I want to ask about the other end of the spectrum, which is in fine dining restaurants, especially ones of your caliber, they sort of, like, caviar and truffles are almost a requirement, you know, for your clientele. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. Is it a useful dish enhancer? Does it really contribute unmatchable flavor, or is it sort of like a necessary evil, like the clientele wants a couple types of caviar and we supply that to them because we're a restaurant and that's what we do? Like, where do you fall on that spectrum?
It's one of those things that I love and hate. It's that love and hate relationships where if it's available, I will have it on the menu because my clientele at the restaurant is demanding to see it. And then there's part of me that loves to eat it as well, but do I have to have it in a dish, or do I have to feel like it's gonna enhance the dish? Not necessarily. And especially when it comes to something like truffles, it's one of those things that could be amazing, but it could also taste like nothing. So I think as a chef, you also have to, like, look at the quality of product coming in and don't take the first batch for the season. Maybe wait till it actually matures and are at its best, and don't start off too early. And I think we just need to maybe be a little bit harder on ourselves when it comes to the quality of the ingredients.
Because the listings on your tasting menu are quite sparse in their descriptors, I would love to dive deeper into a specific dish. Have you break down its components and preparation? So I'm happy to let you choose anything from the menu. Obviously, it's your menu, but I did see something called Arctic Bird's Nest, which honestly, I have no idea what comes on that dish because it's pretty vague, I assume on purpose. So if you would be willing to talk through that one, great. If you want to choose another one, cool. But just if you can kind of unpack a dish for us, that would be awesome.
Sure. So that dish started almost 6 years ago today, I think. And it was one of those dishes that took me... I think it's still being developed today and changed. But the idea came from, we used to have a signature dish on the menu that I felt was very much in still in its 80s. So that dish I turned into what the Arctic Bird's Nest is today. So with all the components on there, you have little eggs that are created from a goat cheese parfait. There's a liquid egg yolk inside made from sea buckthorn curd. We are using some things to make sure that we can freeze the goat cheese parfait and keep the egg yolk liquid, which was probably the one that took me almost 6 or 7 months to figure out how to do. Getting very drunk in the process.
There's some sort of, like, agent that allows it to stay emulsified but not freeze? Is that...
Yes.
So it's use aquavit? What do you use?
There's some aquavit in it, yes, okay. And then some other things.
Cool.
I don't really want to sure. tell or share
the secret Arctic Bird's Nest recipe. Okay, cool. So
you have those, and they're dipped in a white chocolate and brown chocolate speckles. It sits on top of a blueberry sorbet. Around it is a nest made from honey twill, and there's chocolate branches. They are dirt there that's actually made from the recipe of from my grandmother's chocolate cake that we bake and then completely destroy and grind up to resemble dirt. We also produce some halva to resemble feathers on the dish. And just before serving, there's also some gold leaves and snow that's made out of frozen yogurt. Mostly because I've always felt that in Nordic countries, you have the birds laying egg and then the next day it's snowing. So I wanted to get that incorporated into the dish as well.
Just as I suspected, it has 45 components and three words on the menu. I also saw on your menu, and I'm intrigued by this, what is 7X Wagyu?
So 7X Wagyu is a beef coming out of Colorado, mm-hmm. and it's a company we've been working with for probably the last 4 years. Their beef is very well, I don't know if maintained is the right word, but it's very sustainable and they treat their animal well and they get to grow and have a life. The meat and the quality of it is one of the best I've ever tasted in U.S. As close as you can come to Japanese almost. And the 7X is actually the name of the farm. So,
and from a sourcing perspective, how often are you approached or do you approach new purveyors in order to obtain product? You have a very large menu. Obviously, we just outlined that there's a lot of components on many of the dishes. A large part of the kitchen team at a high-end restaurant's role is to source amazing product. How much of that falls to you specifically and only you, or how much of it now falls to a CDC or your SUS that are maybe tasting new product from purveyors and things like that?
I think so far I'm the one who's sourcing out purveyors and being approached as well by them. But I've always felt that I'm very loyal to the purveyors who signed on board with me 4 years ago when I took over. And they been backing me up and making sure everything is on point. So I wouldn't say it's very easy to come in as a new purveyor. I'm very loyal and stubborn in that way that you really have to prove that you have something that none of them have. So I'm very persistent because I'm very hard to get a hold of.
In terms of plating, much of the food that you're seeing coming out of restaurants today, at least from my perspective, are heavily influenced by Nordic plating. There's a sort of very composed precision to detail that exists in your plates. For me, it's kind of coincidental that we were just talking about the Wagyu, but it sort of represents Japanese technique. Like, it appears very light and minimal, even when it's not. Why do Nordic cuisine plates look like that? How has your style kind of evolved in plating? I know there's a lot there, I guess the main question is like, why do the plates that you put out look the way that they do? How do you organize your plates?
Oh, wow. I think everything always comes down to flavor profile and the textures of a dish, and then everything gets played around to in the kitchen, and you kind of have this sense of like when you're plating something, you feel like it's too easy, and then that's when you start complicating it. But I always feel like I want a dish to look like it's very simple. But then when you actually really look at it, you start to realize all the layers to it. And you start to think that, wow, every little thing is here and there and there's another thing. So I want it to be very easy to take in for the eye, but if you really wanted to look into it more, you'll see all the layers and the depth of the dish.
How would you describe your leadership style in the kitchen? How do you approach the day-to-day of prep, service, and organizing your team?
I think I'm very patient. But I always feel like you have to get a chance to learn. And I'm not a big yeller or screamer, or I'm more of the silent type who would approach anyone and ask them if they're happy with it, if they're proud with it, if they did their best they think they could. And most of the time, they'll figure it out themselves that maybe they didn't. And then they'll fix it, and very rarely do they do the same mistake again. And I feel like I see of it as a little bit as a backwards psychology to it, where I think it's better if everyone that does something realize that I can tell someone that they're doing it wrong, or I can yell at them and tell them that's horrible. But if you don't realize it yourself, then nothing is ever going to change. So I try and have that mentality in the kitchen where everyone has to figure it out and love what they're doing. A little bit like I got taught in the beginning of my career as well, where the best way to learn is to figure it out. And I'm there, and my sous chefs are there, and everyone is there as a mentor. And I encourage everyone to always ask questions. There's never any stupid questions. And believe me, there's many stupid questions, but that's totally fine. I'd rather have you ask them. But so that's a little bit like how I'm trying to run the kitchen.
What worries you day to day in the operations of the restaurant? Is there anything that, I mean, you've been at Aquavit for a long time, and you've been in a leadership role for several years now. Is there anything that you still feel like you're still getting your feet underneath you on? Is there anything that's keeps you up at night?
Wow. Many things keeps me up at night. But I think nowadays it's the smaller things. In the beginning, it was more a worry of keeping staff or people walking out or finding purveyors. I think now it's still having staff, actually, but it's more about, did this get ordered, or do they know that they're working, or is someone's gonna call in sick, and more those worries, or we need to change the dishes or something like that. But
from a staffing perspective, are you finding that, are you having a trouble obtaining the high level of staff that you need at, I guess, what we'll call affordable price point? Everyone wants to, I mean, we would all love to pay our staff $50 an hour, like they had a normal desk job. Like, people at a desk job make $65,000-$70,000 a year, and of course we want to pay our cooks that. But I'm curious, are you finding that that the level of talent that you're able to acquire is sometimes not commensurate with what you need occasionally at a 2 Michelin star restaurant?
It's very difficult to find staff, and I don't always necessarily think it has to do with salary as well, but it's just a matter of getting people in who have the focus and the love for it. This it's not all about the level you are, and I don't always inquire to have the fully seasoned cooks in my kitchen. I hire a lot of students out of schools, and it's more that drive and that precision and that love for it that I feel like it's missing. I feel like everyone has a very rush sense of becoming a head chef or executive chef, and no one really wanted to put in the work to go through the lines first. And I think that's the hardest part to keep.
Where can Aquavit go from here? Is the third Michelin star a true goal that you and your staff are focusing on? Have you had meetings? Do you make plans in order to try to achieve that and think about how that can be a goal? Or is that not part of the day-to-day planning discussion at Aquavit?
Not on a day-to-day discussion, no, but it's definitely there, and it's something that we do want to see in the future. Are we there to strive for it now? I don't think so. I think we still have some growing to do, and I feel like where we are right now, I'm very humbled and blessed to be able to have the two Michelin stars and have customers be happy and write good reviews and come back and celebrate with us. So I feel at the moment this is where we need to be, but are we looking for the future for three stars? Yeah, of course we are. But I feel like it needs to take its time to get there.
Let's fast forward way past hopefully three Michelin stars and you being at Aquavit for a long time. I found a quote that said that your dream would be to open a fine dining bed and breakfast. I'm curious, is that still the dream? Is it a dream, or has that changed? And if this is still in fact sort of your end goal, dream, retirement scenario, where might that exist? Is it returning home?
It's definitely on my retirement agenda, or it's somewhere where I feel like I when kitchen might get too rough on me. That's definitely a goal further along my lifespan that I look for. It will be in a warmer country than Sweden, but it will be along the ocean. If it's Portugal or Spain, or if it's on this side of the Atlantic, in U.S. or South America, I don't know. I just know that it will be by the ocean, and it will be a place to settle down and finish off my life the way I wanted.
Chef, thanks so much for being here. Tell everyone who's listening where they can find you, where the restaurant is located.
So you'll find me at Aquavit. It's on 55th between Madison and Park.
And open for breakfast, lunch, dinner. What are the services like?
not breakfast. So we open for lunch and dinner Monday to Friday, and then Saturdays do dinner. This Saturday coming up, it's actually one of our biggest holidays in Sweden, called Midsummer. So we do open for a traditional Swedish smorgasbord this Saturday for brunch. So once a year.
Cool. Yeah. All right, everyone, go check that out. Chef, thanks again for being here. Really appreciate you being on the show and telling us your story.
Thank you for having me.
And everyone who's listening, join us every Tuesday for another episode of The Line here on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.